From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump and Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer just finished a contentious meeting at the White House. The president says he won't sign a government funding bill unless it includes $5 billion for a border wall. Democrats say they won't go over $1.3 billion. No deal means a possible government shutdown in 10 days, the latest after the news. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. So appreciate your listening, whether it's today 89.3, one of our many transmitters in Southern California, or listening worldwide at kpecc.org or on the KPECC app. Coming up, the further encroachment of Christmas music into everyday life, radio, TV, shopping. We can't escape the music. Starts weeks before Thanksgiving. And at what point is Christmas music no longer special or even seasonal? That's coming up later this hour. But first, as you just heard on NPR News, wasn't the season for giving. In a tense White House meeting just about half an hour ago, President Trump got into it with Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. It began with a rather mild disagreement.
But there are no votes in the House, a majority of votes, for a wall, no matter where you start.
Exactly right. You don't have
if I needed the votes for the wall in the House, I would have them in one session, would be done.
Go do it.
It doesn't help because we need 10 Democrats in the Senate.
No, don't put it on the Senate. Put it on the negotiation.
Okay, let me ask you this. And we're doing this in a very friendly manner. It doesn't help for me to take a vote in the House where I will win easily with the Republicans.
You will not win.
It doesn't help to take that vote. Because I'm not going to get the vote of the Senate. I need 10 senators. That's the problem.
Mr. President, you have the White House. You have the Senate.
I have the White House. The White House is done. And the House would give me the vote if I wanted it. But I can't because I need, Nancy, I need 10 votes from Chuck.
But it got more contentious from there.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell you
disagree.
What, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
Good.
Of shutting down.
That is
and I'm going to shut it down for border
security. But we
security.
Believe you shouldn't
okay.
shut it down.
All right. So with us to talk about rather remarkable confrontation at the White House, congressional reporter for Politico, Sarah Farah. Sarah, thank you for joining us. What was anticipated to come out of this meeting in which cameras were allowed?
Well, no one on Capitol Hill was really expecting this meeting to go smoothly. Obviously, there's some really big disputes here on border wall funding, but no one that I've talked to expected it to be quite this extraordinary. This was a really, really unusual conversation. Not only did was far more of it televised than was expected, and at times you actually heard the Democratic leaders try to get the cameras to leave the room so that they could talk privately. But also the content of the discussions with President Trump actually taking blame for a potential shutdown was just not something that Democratic leaders had been expecting.
Well, and so I know it's only been a little over half an hour since this took place, but have you had a chance to talk with any members of Congress to get their response to this?
So I've been able to talk to some of the aides in the Democratic Party, and they are pretty elated that this transpired the way it did, with President Trump actually saying he would be, quote, proud to preside over a government shutdown next week. This is a shutdown that would take place over Christmas, possibly into the new year. This would be politically damaging for the Republican Party. And yet President Trump is saying he would be happy to do it if it means getting the border wall funding up to the really getting that to center stage. And so Democratic aides that I've been talking to think this is very good for Democratic leadership. There's no talk now of Leader Schumer being blamed for a shutdown like he was for the shutdown earlier this year in January. And Leader Pelosi can really strengthen her hand here just by replaying those comments from Trump, which so clearly demonstrate that he's willing and ready to take the government to the brink.
For the president's core supporters, this would likely play well because they would see him as standing up, taking a stand where he's not backing down from the $5 billion he says is necessary for the border wall. But I wonder about Republicans generally, if they're concerned beyond that core, that this could damage the Republican Party with the president taking that degree of responsibility for a shutdown.
Yeah, that's going to be the huge question going forward. He's taking a huge political gamble here. I don't think this is what Republican leaders on Capitol Hill would have advised the president to say today, especially not on camera. And House Republicans who are here right now, a lot of them are leaving. Either they're retiring or they were kicked out of office. They don't want to be seen. They don't want to be here through Christmas, through New Year's. They don't even want to be here next week at all. They're ready to leave and let the new Democratic Congress, the new Democratic House, really take responsibility for the funding fight next year. So not only do House Republican leaders have to deal with whatever Trump is throwing at them, but they also have to appease their dozens of members who are retiring or leaving at the end of this year.
So he's dug in on the $5 billion, and Democrats, what they're willing to go $1.3 billion for additional border security, and sounds like that they're saying that's the most we're going to do. It doesn't sound like any room for compromise. That's a huge gap.
Right, and those positions are hardening. We saw both Democratic leaders before they went into that meeting insisting that they weren't going to give any new border money. The $1.3 billion for the fencing has actually already been approved. This is the same amount that was approved for the current year. So they're not offering any new border money. And the president, of course, wants more than double that and has actually asked for as much as $25 billion. So he could even have an unpredictable stance of going above that at some point. So there's a lot of space between those two numbers. And Democratic leaders, they really think they have the upper hand with the president going on television and saying these things and really stoking a shutdown here.
We're talking with Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico. Sarah, I so appreciate your time. I know you're jamming on deadline, but just real quickly, if the limited government shutdown happens in 10 days, does that thoroughly close down non-essential government services?
So it would be a partial shutdown. There's about a quarter of the federal government, a dozen agencies that aren't funded. This includes Homeland Security, of course, as well as the Department of Commerce and several other agencies. The essential services would still be functioning. So TSA would be part of this, but we will still have security agents at airports over the Christmas holiday, and there will be border security agents on the border. Those sorts of things aren't going to be shuttered. But overall, government agencies won't be able to train new employees. They'll have to halt any kind of non-essential services, which the heads of these agencies have been very vocal about would be damaging to their department.
Sarah, thank you so much again. Really appreciate your taking this time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Ferris, Politico's congressional reporter. Remarkable meeting at the White House, President Trump, and Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. We'll continue to cover the story throughout the day with only 10 days until the government funding runs out. An agreement has to be reached on continuing funding. It's Air Talk on 89.3. In the years since e-scooters first started traveling the streets of Los Angeles County, the growth in e-scooters has skyrocketed. According to the Wall Street Journal, though, potential investors are starting to get a bit hesitant. Companies like Bird and Lime aren't yet 2 years old. They've seen huge growth, but they're also seeing significant growing pains and backlash in some communities against the scooters. With us, Wall Street Journal tech reporter Greg Bensinger. Greg, thank you for joining us. What are some of the growing pains the scooter companies are seeing?
Well, it comes down to money. They're trying to raise funding rounds, particularly before the real chill of winter descends upon us. And in cities where it's too cold to ride these things outside, they're going to see the rides go down significantly. That's not a good story to tell potential investors. So they're trying to wrap up their funding rounds, and they've discovered that once eager investors are saying, "Wait a minute, maybe it's too expensive to buy in right now. Maybe you've hit your growth numbers, and we should wait or raise it at lower valuations than you were hoping for."
We also hear about a backlash by residents against the scooters to where there are videos online of people finding creative ways of destroying or incapacitating the e-scooters. What's your sense of how that's adding to the cost of doing business for Bird and Lime?
Well, it's significant, and you're right. There are videos of these things being thrown in rivers or fished out of rivers. There are videos of them being broken apart and pictures of the same all over the sidewalk. Yeah, some residents feel like these things are a nuisance. They line the sidewalks. They line the grass paths by the sidewalk, and they're hard to navigate the street and the sidewalk against. So there is a backlash. Some people go out and cause damage to these things, or they cause them to be inoperable, or they cause them to disappear, and that adds serious cost. If you can't use the scooter, you can't charge people to use it, and that's what they want to show investors.
Greg Bensinger of the Wall Street Journal with us. Also joining us from Curbed LA, senior reporter Patrick Sisson. Patrick, how are the companies trying to fight back against the vandalism and theft of the scooters?
Well, and to Greg's great points, these scooters are sort of like they're vehicles for making money, not just vehicles for getting people around. If a scooter can cost less to produce, last longer, that means they can get more profit per ride and make back their initial investment quicker. So what the companies are doing are making more durable scooters. Both Lime and Bird have been starting to design their own models. You see them with longer battery life, so they're enough to charge them as much, and they can keep it in the field longer. You see them with braking cords and pedals inside sort of the shaft of the scooter, so they don't get cut or damaged as much. You see more durable wheels and just basically an entirely more durable product, so you can, leave it out longer and get more rides out of every scooter.
Love to hear from AirTalk listeners your thought about the future of e-scooters, given the backlash against them and the softening investment market for the two biggest companies in the space, Bird and Lime. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Patrick, I've heard just anecdotally that some riders are finding it difficult to find scooters that are charged for whatever reason. They're not being picked up and charged as frequently in some cases as necessary. How much of a challenge has that become for the companies? Patrick, you there?
Yeah, in terms of the challenge of
keeping them ready for people to use.
Yeah, well, it is quite a challenge. Bird and Lime sort of started out by having a contract workforce. They hire people to pick them up during the day and in the evenings. And it's a very common sight. I lived in Venice, and you'll see people like riding four or five scooters stacked up on top of each other just to get back to a charging site so they can charge them and get them back out. It has been a big challenge. And you're seeing Lyft and Uber, which are entering the market, they actually have their own sort of in-house services. They bring them back to their own warehouses to charge them and then put them back out. It's, again, just a matter of how do you get these things out in the field, keep them from getting broken, and basically maximize your earning potential. And that's something that the designers of these companies are looking at very seriously.
Greg, is there any concern also that if cities start enforcing the ordinances against riding them on the sidewalk, that that's going to make them less attractive because there'd be far fewer people willing to ride them exclusively in the street?
Yeah, that's a concern, and especially if cities start enforcing another ordinance in some places, which is wear a helmet. Most riders, you'll observe, do not take those safeguards, and they're going to get in an accident. I guarantee there's going to be some incident that's horrible that's going to cause the industry to think about these kind of safety issues. And cities are also fighting back in a different way, which is just limiting the number that are allowed in the city. Here in San Francisco, where I am, The city went through a permitting process, and they said only these two scooter companies could operate here with a very limited number of scooters available. And you can imagine tech companies want to tell the world, we flooded the place with scooters. They're available wherever you want them. But cities, in fact, are saying that's not going to be a good system.
And are they enforcing it, though? Because one of the issues has just been whether there's the person power to go out and write citations or do a census of the number of e-scooters that are out there. I don't know. In San Francisco, are they able to really enforce the ordinance?
Yeah, they've just said this is the number you can have. If we find that you have more than that, that's it. You're going to get fined. So San Francisco and the scooter companies here are taking it seriously. And you know, when they first arrived here, they just arrived overnight. You couldn't believe it. There was two or three scooter companies with just scooters everywhere, and there was no limit on them. And now it's pretty limited. You can tell there's a difference. You can tell there's fewer. They just don't crowd up the sidewalk like they used to when they're parked.
Astrogoth writes on the page, 3 days ago, a Chinese company started selling on eBay a conversion kit allowing people to take one of the e-scooters, recharge it at home, and disconnect the phone home part of its brain so that you could steal and turn the scooter into your own. Certainly, there are going to be some people who are going to steal stuff. But what's promised here is that you don't have to take the scooter with you everywhere you go. The idea is the convenience that you can drop it off, pick it up when you want. You don't have to lug a scooter around with you every place. Jack writes on the page, even Wall Street, a place prone to herd mentality, realizes this is a fad that'll go poof within 2 years. Albert, in the Fairfax District, you're on Air Talk.
Larry, thank you for taking my call. I'm a big fan of yours. Nick Scully, you're the greatest.
Well, gosh, thank you.
Yeah. So I've been a show from Los Angeles for 25 years. The streets are inundated with people riding these scooters with headsets on, and they have no idea how to drive safely. I come very close to getting hit by somebody coming out of a storefront, somebody on the sidewalk. I've talked to law enforcement. I've talked to EMT drivers. If you were to Google these birds, you get a page about lawyers who take bird cases. So I think you'd be really well, it'd be a great idea to go to emergency rooms and see how many people are coming in there with injuries from scooters.
So you think they're going to last or not?
I hope they don't. I hope they're gone as soon as possible. They're an eyesore. People leave them on sidewalks. They leave them in gutters. They just abandon them.
All right, Albert, thanks for the call. Talk with Matt joins us from Glendale. You're on Air Talk. What do you think?
I think this just screams a little bit of government overreach. I think let's try and see all the positives, like the fact that this may be a great solution for people who can't afford a car, who want to get to work, who want to be able to have a couple of wheels under their feet instead of having to wait for a bus that's late or a train that breaks down, what have you. I think let's tighten up some of the loose ends that are, that exist. But I think it's kind of a good thing.
All right, Matt, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, a very divisive issue because there's so many people who think this is a tremendous last mile solution for public transit or for cutting down on the length of a walk that has to be made, that this really solves a problem. But obviously, it's created problems in its experimental nature. Althea in View Park says, here's another problem. Cities are issuing tickets to underage scooter riders. My son racked up a $726 ticket for being an underage rider and not wearing a helmet. The vehicles look like they're for teenagers, yet they can't legally ride them. That's Althea in View Park in Los Angeles. Fiesel writes on the page, the safety issue are the crumbling streets and lack of spaces to ride. Cities can save lives by dedicating lanes to bikes and scooters. Same with parking. We need dedicated parking. Bike and scooter parking takes a fraction of the space cars take up and don't cause climate change. That's Lost Fiesel, writing on the page. My thanks to writer Greg Benzinger of the Wall Street Journal and Patrick Sisson, senior reporter for Curbed LA. You can share your comments about e-scooters and their future on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, the latest on the embattled LA Unified School District. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, Kyle Stokes, KPECC, K-12 education reporter, joining us with the very latest on the LA Unified School District. Kyle, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
So let's start with labor strife in LAUSD.
Yes.
UTLA, the union representing teachers, has already authorized a potential strike. They're going through this whole mediation process. Where does that stand?
Well, so recently, in fact, last week, the two sides met with a state fact finder, a fact finding panel. And this is the last stage in the process of going that the state law requires for the two sides to go through before the teachers union can legally go on strike. So a fact finder comes in, takes a look at all of the evidence and issues and arguments at stake, makes a recommendation as to how the fact finder thinks that the dispute should be settled. That recommendation is coming up next week. The hearing is done. They met for the hearing and then met for two other mediation sessions where they tried to work out their differences. And the two sides announced that they were not able to resolve their differences in those mediation sessions. So all we're really waiting for now is the fact finder's report. It's due on December 14th, which is the end of this week. And at that point, we're going to get kind of the fact finders ruling on, sort of
and that's
this argument
an attempt
about
to get a neutral perspective
right.
on this.
And we really need a neutral perspective because the two sides could not be farther apart in terms of how they view the central issue of this negotiation, which is how fiscally healthy is the LA Unified School District. To hear the union talk about it, the district has all of this money stashed away in reserves and is refusing to spend it, hoarding it for some rainy day that the union thinks has arrived. On the other hand, the district says we are literally running out of money. We're on a fast track to insolvency. And so it's hard to reconcile those two visions. That's sort of the fact finder's job. And I think I'm personally very interested to see where the fact finder comes down on this, because we've been living between these two polar opposite views of the district's fiscal situation for so long. And finally, we've got a neutral arbiter coming in to try and get a sense of where things actually stand.
And then there's sort of sub-skirmishes to this. I got a release from the district a few days ago filing an unfair labor practices complaint against UTLA. The claim is that the unions instructed teachers not to show up for meetings.
Right, to faculty meetings.
Yeah, yeah. So, you've got a number of these going back and forth that are part of this process.
The latest in a series of these unfair labor practice charges that have gone back and forth. The union has countered at points, I'm not sure exactly of the date, but that the district has been withholding information that the union is requesting to take part in the negotiation. You know, things like how much money do we have, questions about documents, requests for information. The union is charged that the district hasn't provided that information. And the district has also, countercharged that the union has never really been participating in these negotiations, which have been going on over the course of 20 months now in good faith. The district has said pretty flatly that they feel like the union has been angling for a strike all along.
We have South LA resident asking on the Air Talk page whether the U.S. Supreme Court decision on public employee unions, whether that's had any effect to your knowledge on UTLA's negotiating clout here?
It's definitely, I think it's one of the things that is in the air right now that I think makes UTLA members a little bit more likely to and more willing to kind of step off the ledge here and move into the strike. You've got the Janus decision, which will, I think it raises a lot of questions about the future of public employee unions. The Janus decision meaning that you essentially don't have to be a mandatory member. It isn't mandatory for you to be a union if you're a public employee in a place like a school, which is unionized. That will undercut the union going forward. I think there's sort of like a counter move by the unions to organize around that and say, we need to stand together in this moment. And I think that definitely plays into the strike. There's also a general feeling around teachers unions right now with what happened in Arizona, West Virginia.
What happened in Arizona?
In Arizona and West Virginia, where there were huge teacher walkouts over over lack of state funding for education. It's different in terms of the on the ground realities of red state teacher union politics versus, you know, California's blue state union politics. In red states like Arizona and West Virginia, the teachers unions had been battered and bruised for so long, whereas in California, they are still a dominant political force. But I still think here on the ground in L.A., people point to those protests and say we need to carry our weight on, you know, in a similar way here. We need to contribute to the union movement on our for our own right. So that plus the Supreme Court decision, I do think plays into UTLA's willingness to strike.
So I know this is going to be a big deal once the fact finders release their report in just a few days. But jumping ahead, so let's say they still can't reach agreement. When are we looking at potential picket lines?
Yeah. So December 14th is when the fact finder report is due. The fact finder report is the recommendations for how to resolve the strike. This recommendation could become the blueprint for an agreement for the two sides, but it is also non-binding. So neither side has to accept it. So at that point, the teachers union could legally say we go on strike. The thing about December 14th is that it is the last day of school before LAUSD's winter break, which lasts well into January at this point. So the likelihood that the teachers union would go on strike in December seems to me to be pretty low.
It would defeat the purpose.
It would defeat the purpose. It certainly would be bad programming to go on strike at Christmas. You know, I think we're looking at potentially early January. I think if you're a parent in LAUSD, that's when you should maybe think about your contingency plans or what you're going to do. I mean, you know, the schools would be open at that point. But I've talked to a lot of parents who are concerned about crossing the picket lines and sending their kids to school across the teacher picket line. You know, so there's that sort of factor that I think parents are going to have to weigh. Figure out what you plan to do. You might have to make a real decision come the first week of January, potentially.
Yeah, some parents might not economically have a choice. But
And I should just throw in there, too, that the two sides could go back to the bargaining table after fact-finding is over. And you know, what that three-week winter break provides is potentially that window for, you know, for creating that space to negotiate.
Yeah, could move both sides off of the positions they hold right now. We're talking with KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. So, Kyle, we have upcoming school board election to fill the seat Ref Rodriguez had, who ended up being indicted for campaign finance alleged malfeasance. So how does that factor into the board majority issue with charter schools versus UTLA?
Yeah, this is going to be a really pivotal election because what with the election of 2017, with the addition of two more members who were endorsed by charter schools, it gave the candidates who at one point had been endorsed by charter schools either a 4 or a 5-seat majority on the board. If you include Ref Rodriguez, the two new candidates, the board president Monica Garcia and Richard Vladovic, who represents the south end of the district all the way down to the harbor, he had at one point been endorsed by both CCSA and UTLA. So it was sort of a swing vote. When Ref Rodriguez stepped off the board, it sort of took that, you know, solidly 4-seat majority and took it down to 3, potentially 4, really made Richard Vladovic's vote a very pivotal vote on that board. If the teachers union was able to win back this seat, which they had held before Ref Rodriguez won it in 2015, it would be a big win for their ability to sort of stymie charter forces and their ability to bring policy ideas forward. I should say, though, that this is all kind of, we're talking about the proxy war here. Charters and teachers unions are just the biggest spenders, but charters versus teachers unions is not the active issue that's on the agenda at the school board every week. So it's important to caveat that here, that we're talking about the independent expenditure war that's going to play out in the campaign and not necessarily live issues necessarily.
Well, so much of it is symbolism, like the state school superintendent race, where that position doesn't even have much power.
Yes.
But it's about symbolic, and millions of dollars were spent. Tony Thurmond, the union-backed candidate, the one who won that race. But it's not going to bring about significant change in California public school policy.
Right. But there are, you know, very interesting ways in which the two sides do still have to build bridges over this. I think think it's important to put that caveat in because we tend to talk only about teachers' unions and charter schools in terms of policy. That doesn't mean that the election is not going to be pivotal in that, you know, sense of this war that continues to go on between charters and teachers' unions.
Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. I appreciate it very much. Kyle Stokes, KPCC reporter. Coming up after our update, we're going to talk about Christmas music saturating the radio airwaves, streaming services. You've got Christmas music everywhere. At what point does it lose its specialness and not even be seasonal anymore? It starts so early, before Thanksgiving. We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes.
But baby, it's cold outside.
Got to go.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop in. I'll hold your hands, they're just
Dean Martin with what's become a controversial Christmas song, Baby It's Cold Outside. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I don't know if you saw the San Francisco radio station, which was one of a number of outlets that pulled that song off of its Christmas playlist, did a poll of its listeners to ask them, what do you want to keep it off or bring it back? And apparently they overwhelmingly voted to bring the song back. So Coit Radio in San Francisco is now playing Baby It's Cold Outside and its various versions. But I wanted to spend less time on that controversy and more on the general trend of Christmas music taking over the sounds of the nation beginning before Thanksgiving, from commercial radio stations, streaming services, Spotify, huge listening to Christmas music there. Can't go into a store seemingly for more than a month without hearing Christmas music as the backdrop. And the question is, at what point does it lose its specialness or even stop being seasonal? Like to hear from you your thoughts on where we stand on Christmas music. Now, if you've always hated it, then it's not really relevant. But if you're someone who has been a lover of Christmas music, are you starting to get burned out on it and why? And what for you was the tipping point in that? If you're someone who loves Christmas music and is thrilled to see it available so many places and so many different recordings and almost every artist in the world seemingly doing a Christmas record now, maybe this is a golden era for you in Christmas music. Share that with us, please. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let me just share some findings from Nielsen, which is the rating service for radio, television too. But they went out and looked at, well, who's playing Christmas music on the radio and who listens to it? And last year they released this. They found that for holiday music fans, over a third of them are millennials. They are the biggest group. This is not an older person thing. 18 to 34-year-old listeners are the biggest chunk of Christmas music listeners with 36%. Gen Xers, that's 35 to 54-year-olds, follow, is the next largest category. They're almost a third of the number. Baby boomers, slightly less, despite their huge numbers. And those who are over age 55, 25%. Gen Zers, age 13 to 17, 8%. So it's fascinating. Millennials and Gen Xers are the big, they make up more than two-thirds of the listeners to Christmas music, which I found rather surprising. The ratings lift that adult contemporary stations get when they switch to an all-Christmas music format, their ratings go up 72% on average. So you wonder why radio stations are doing it. It's about the money. It's about the ears, that many people that are listening. But what about recording artists? They clearly are following the money, too. And with us, Los Angeles Times pop music writer Randy Lewis, who is has for the 24th year compiled the L.A. Times Holiday Music Roundup. Randy, good to have you with us again.
Hi, Larry. Good to be here again.
So share with us how big an increase we've seen on the recording side of this. It seems like almost no artists go without making a Christmas album.
Well, it does seem an inevitability when you're in the music business to sooner or later get around to making a Christmas album. I mean, there are a couple of good examples. Just this year, this relatively young group, Pentatonix, which is an a cappella group, they just put out their third Christmas collection, and they've been in existence about a decade. So they're turning it into a cottage industry. On the other side of the extreme, Eric Clapton just put out a Christmas album called Happy Christmas. And, you know, who of us who were, you know, listening to him in the 60s and 70s would have ever thought he'd be doing Christmas music. But it is, as you say, something that people can't seem to get enough of. And so eventually, just about everybody tries their hand at it.
Oh, we're talking with Randy Lewis. I also found it fascinating. Nielsen also looked at the app-based music services like Spotify and found that streaming captured the largest share of holiday music listening at 40%. So Spotify and Pandora and Apple, all these streamers, 40%. Radio is next, over the air. And satellite at just over a quarter of the listening. Digital music library like iTunes accounts for 13%. Physical music, so we're talking CDs, vinyl, other physical sources, 12%. And other, I don't even know what that would be at 10%. Was that make your own Christmas music, I guess? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rose in Glassell Park, you're on AirTalk.
Yes, and hello, Randy Lewis. This is Rose Apodaca, actually. But we have a retail store called A+R, and for the last 13 years that we've been in business, I insist on no Christmas music, even though we do a lot of, a lot of our clientele come in for gifts. We play anything but Christmas music because I just want to extend some relief to them, and they actually are very happy about it. And they notice it right away when they walk in.
What kind of what do you sell in your store?
Well, we sell modern design, so everything from electric tea kettles to furniture, actually, all modern.
Okay, but so you don't change your playlist for the holidays at all?
No, not at all. And like I said, our customers are very happy about it.
Right. And it's funny that they make a point, hey, no Christmas music. 866-893-KPECC. If you have a store or a restaurant, I'm also interested how you decide whether you play Christmas music as part of your ambiance or whether you've decided, like Rose said, nope, they're not going to do that in their store. 866-893-KPECC. Dan in Diamond Bar, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I love Christmas music. I have a CD of jazz piano by Bill Cunliffe that's Christmas songs, and I listen to it in July sometimes. But that's my choice. I think the push of Christmas is too much when it's so early and all the time. And I had an experience on November 1st. I attended a conference at the Marriott Airport Hotel in Long Beach, right by the Long Beach Airport.
Yeah.
We went into the meeting at 8 a.m. the day after Halloween. When we came out for a break, about 10 or so, it was Christmas. There were trees.
Well, you're talking about the larger issue, Dan, of the physical presence of Christmas taking over spaces. Yeah, Halloween. Amazing. 866-893-KPECC. You have good taste listening to the terrific jazz pianist Bill Cunliffe. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Samantha writes on the page, from a fourth-generation atheist, I love Christmas music, she writes, especially the canon of English carols. There are so many beautiful, austere arrangements by English composers that are truly wonderful, especially when performed in a frosty cathedral. However, we absolutely strictly aren't allowed to listen to it until after Thanksgiving. Samantha, thank you for the posting. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Is it Marini in Santa Monica? Is that right?
Oh, and it's Marini.
Like Marini. Thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I'm a folklorist. Got my PhD at UCLA. Barry Tolkien just passed away, a stupendous folklorist, spent 43 years collecting Navajo stories from Hugh Yellowman, an extraordinary storyteller. And at his death, his family came to Barry Tolkien and said, "You can't play these tapes outside of winter because these stories and songs are to be orally performed only at certain times of the year, during the winter between the first killing frost and the first lightning stroke, during solstices and during eclipses, moments that are defined by the larger movements of nature, not the immediate agendas of humans."
So you want to see a similar restriction on Christmas music?
Saying this, many cultures recognize this, that certain sacred songs have they're sacred, and I'm not saying with a capital S, right? Just they're powerful mythically, and people need their power. And when you play them outside of their time, you're turning them into something that saps them of their power.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. Thank you for that. Randy Lewis, what do you think about her argument?
Well, I think, you know, there is a time and a place, and especially for particular music that is geared to the season or the rituals, the spiritual aspect of this time of year, of course, goes back thousands of years. So that makes sense, and I'm entirely empathetic.
But of course, business prevails. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll continue with more of your phone calls as we talk about Christmas music proliferating seemingly everywhere we go. As we listen to Mariah heading into our break, we'll be back in 1 minute.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Eartha Kitt, of course, from 1953, one of the standards of Christmas, having fun with the holiday, Eartha Kitt. We're talking about Christmas music being omnipresent, whether you go to stores, go to the dry cleaners. It's like every place you step into, doctor's offices, dental offices, Christmas music surrounds us. And if you're a fan of Christmas music, do you love that? Or do you feel that we've reached the saturation point and even with all the content dramatically increasing, that it's oversaturated and taken the special seasonal nature out of the music? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Alicia writes on the Air Talk page, "Us Gen Xers and millennials are the ones with young kids. My kids love it and want to listen to it all the time. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't." That's Alicia responding to Nielsen, finding that overwhelmingly the biggest consumers of Christmas music are millennials and Gen Xers. 866-893-KPCC. Jubril in West Adams wants to know, Randy, whether people just put out Christmas albums to fulfill contractual agreements with record companies. Jubril thinks, you know, maybe artists just do this because it's an easy way to meet a quota for albums. Know anything about that?
Well, there's probably some truth to that, and some of them sound like it. But there are a lot of examples where people seem to take it seriously and put a lot of thought, attention into these. But I don't know specifically whether that's written into most contracts as to whether a Christmas collection counts toward your contractual obligation or not.
All right, let's talk with Natalie in Westwood. Good to have you with us. You have a theory on the millennial and Gen Xers' love of Christmas music.
Oh, absolutely, Larry. They haven't been beaten up with it like those of us who have seen 50 are. We sang it in elementary school. We sang it in middle school. We sing it, you hear it everywhere. Christmas music only comes in two flavors. There's "I'm hungry for it," and "Oh God, again," and that
All right, Natalie. Appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Loretta in Santa Barbara also voting for younger folks listen to Christmas music because of their children, that's it's about a family-oriented experience of listening to it. George in Cerritos, you're on Air Talk.
Well, hi, Larry. In 1973, I was 19, working at a Sears Roebuck in the men's department, and felt like I was a prisoner having to listen to Christmas carols for about 6 weeks. And frankly, every time I hear the 12 Days of Christmas, it's a little PTSD experience for me.
I'm sure there are a lot of people. Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, our producer, was sharing about when he worked in a supermarket and said he just couldn't take it because it was just constant over the course of the holiday season. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Bill writes on the page, there are also all the Messiah performances this time of year, too. Only part one of Messiah is Christmas-related. Part two, which includes Hallelujah, is really meant for Resurrection Sunday, not Christmas. But that's a little different because there you're choosing to go to. That's like having, 100 Nutcracker performances on stage. If you're going to go to one, it's one. And you don't have to worry about every dance company doing their version of the Nutcracker. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joanne in Santa Monica said, my daughter and I listen to Christmas music, but we have an agreement we don't listen to it before Thanksgiving. She always asks if I've heard a song by a new artist that I, of course, know, because the new artists always copy what older performers have done. Let's talk next with Rob in Mid-Wilshire. You're on Air Talk.
I'm not sure whether it's a bookshelf or a Bactrian camel, but the Beatles for Baby Boomer.
Yeah.
Christmas is Christmas again. That was a beautiful album. And finally, Bob Dylan, his Christmas album. It was the scariest thing I ever listened to.
Randy Lewis, how did Dylan's Christmas recording do?
It did fairly well. It was interesting to me because I think what he did there, he was paying tribute not to Christmas music, but to Christmas records specifically. So if the pop music geeks could go, oh, this came from a version by this cool little band in Texas, and this came from the Ray Conniff record, and Bob being the musical genius that he is, he was just saluting all these Christmas records he grew up with.
Mohammed in Redondo Beach, I understand you have some restaurants, so what do you decide about what you play?
We used to always play Christmas music, and our young employees, we hire mostly young people, they complain. So now we put it on radio stations where there's a mix of, Christmas music, but also just, regular whatever music that they like. So we don't force it on them anymore.
All right. That sounds like a reasonable thing. Mohammed in Redondo Beach, thank you. I appreciate it very much. My thought's always been, when it comes to radio, if you don't want to listen to Christmas music, don't tune it in. And I wanted a little break from the news, put on my satellite soul station that I often listen to, and it's gone all Christmas, too. So it's everywhere we go, no question about it. Hey, Randy Lewis, L.A. Times pop music writer, thanks so much. We appreciate your being with us.
Okay, thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
And we have a link on our Air Talk page to his 24th annual compilation of the Times Holiday Music Roundup. We leave you with the terrific Donny Hathaway's This Christmas on Air Talk.
Now you say
if only it was as easy as crying a river. Instead, we've got a Colorado that is overtaxed by seven states that are drawing on the river. This hour on Air Talk, we're going to focus on efforts to reach an agreement on how to deal with the Colorado's flow, given the demands on it and historic drought. Also later this hour, we'll take a look at Amazon's efforts to move its cashierless pay system into airports and other places. But first, a series of meetings this week in Las Vegas, bringing the state stakeholders together to try and iron out a deal established by the federal government for diminished flows of the Colorado and how that water is going to be apportioned. With us, Arizona Republic reporter Ian James. Ian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So first of all, explain to us what this tentative plan that the Fed set up, how that was supposed to dole out the water.
So the drought contingency plan has been negotiated by the federal government and representatives of California, Arizona, and Nevada during the past 3 years or so. And what this plan would do is each of those states would leave some of their water supplies temporarily in Lake Mead to try to boost the levels of the reservoir, which is now at just 38% full.
And why is Arizona at this point not yet willing to sign on?
Well, the negotiations in Arizona have been long and difficult. Since around July, they've started holding a regular series of meetings. And there are a number of specifics that have just proven difficult for the parties to decide on, and they have to do with money that would be paid to some parties for kicking in water that would help with the deal, as well as the conditions for some of the parties that would face the biggest cutbacks.
All right. And who are the parties who would see the biggest decrease in allocations of water under the federal government's plan here?
Well, under the drought contingency plan, the way it's been negotiated in Arizona, farmers in Pinal County near Phoenix would face the biggest water cutbacks. And those cutbacks would be about 60% of their Colorado River water supplies under the deal that's been negotiated. But they are at the bottom rung in terms of being junior water rights holders. So the idea is that they would receive funding to help them switch from that Colorado River water to pumping groundwater, and that would make it more palatable for them.
Now, the Central Arizona Project, is any of that water Colorado River, or is that coming from the mountains?
No, yes. All the water in the Central Arizona Project that flows through that canal, all that water is Colorado River water. And the proposed drought contingency plan would shrink that amount by about 18% between 2021 and 2026. So a significant hit for Arizona's water supplies. And so figuring out how to spread around those cutbacks is what the talks have been focusing on.
And that serves urban areas of around Phoenix, right? So it's not just ag we're talking about.
Right. It's about 40% of Phoenix's water supplies that come from the Colorado River, just like about a quarter of the water supplies in Southern California come from the Colorado River. So the cities all across this region have a lot at stake here.
And so who's been lobbying hardest to try and see their allocation increase?
Well, I would say that in Arizona, the parties that have been, really pressing to have, a substantial amount of water still flow to them, and in spite of the cutbacks that are necessary under this deal, would be the farmers in Pinal County. There are several irrigation districts there, and the point that they've been making is, we know everyone has to share in this, but we want to still have our businesses be viable. And so they've made that point pretty strongly.
All right, Ian, thanks very much. We appreciate your joining us. Ian James of the Arizona Republic. In case you just joined us, we're talking about the water meetings being held this week in Las Vegas. The effort is to try and nail down the terms of who gets what amount of water for what purposes from the Colorado River, with years of drought having an impact on the flow of the river and, of course, reservoirs Lake Powell, like Lake Mead, at historic lows. Also with us, manager of Colorado River Resources for the Southern California's Metropolitan Water District, Bill Hazenkamp. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Sure, it's good to be here.
So what does this mean for Southern California water customers who rely on the Colorado?
Well, the Colorado River is vitally important to Southern California. As Ian said, we get about 25% of our Southern California water supply from the Colorado River. And it's been a backbone supply during droughts here in California, being able to rely on the Colorado River to meet our water supply needs.
Now, what are some of the efforts? Ian mentioned effort to bring the level of Lake Mead up. Is MWD doing anything here in Southern California to contribute to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we have a history of working to reduce our dependence on the Colorado River. Back in 2003, we had to cut back our supplies by 20% from the Colorado River permanently. And we did that by a combination of implementing additional conservation measures here in Southern California. Recently, we had a turf removal program where we paid residents to remove their lawns and save water. And we also have a program with the farming community out in the Imperial Valley and the Coachella Valley and the Palo Verde Valley, where we incentivize them to be more efficient with water and take less water from the river. So we have a history of working to reduce our dependence on the Colorado River, but we know that Lake Mead is still going down and we need to do more. And so part of this plan that's going on in Las Vegas this week is for metropolitan and the ag communities in California to step up and do more to reduce our reliance on the river.
What was the thinking of using Lake Mead as the decider as to whether water restrictions need to go into effect? I mean, it's a big system. Why was that determined to be the point of threshold?
Yeah, Lake Mead is the largest reservoir in the United States, and it's a barometer for the health of the Colorado River. All of the water that's delivered to Arizona, Las Vegas, and Southern California comes from Lake Mead. And so Lake Mead, we've seen that level drop over time for the last 19 years. And it's down, as Ian said, 38% of normal. And if it gets drops a little bit more, we're going to start having mandatory cutbacks to the lower basin states. So because it's all of our water comes from Lake Mead, that's all the triggers that we're focusing on.
And how much of a cut? If that happens, if Mead hits that that low level, how much does Southern California have to cut its allocation of Colorado River water?
So fortunately for California, we have a higher priority than Arizona, so we're not subject to that first cut. So the first cut goes to Arizona and Nevada. They have to reduce their use by about 12%. But if the lake continues to drop, eventually California would have to cut back on water, and that would depend on how low the reservoir got.
Okay, so it'd be a sliding scale. But if we have you know, another decade of drought, what's sort of the worst case prediction here of what that means for our river supply water?
Yeah, well, we have, as I said, already cut back by 20%. And we know that we're going to have to cut back some more permanently. And this plan that's in Vegas is to have some smaller cutbacks to start living within our means. But we know in the long run, we're going to have to cut back by another 20 or 30% to have a sustainable Colorado River.
All right. Bill, thank you. Appreciate your talking with us about this. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Bill Hazenkamp is manager of Colorado River Resources for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. They're essentially a wholesaler, so they bring Colorado River water into Southern California through their pipeline. They've got reservoirs here in Southern California, and then that water is sold to local water districts where it's provided to residents, and of course also provided to agriculture. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. In just a moment, we turn our attention to Amazon's efforts to expand cashierless shopping. Mm-hmm. Amazon's already in its brick and mortar stores used the no checkout system for people to purchase things. So the idea is you come into the store, you just scan with your phone, letting it know that you're there. You grab the items you want, you leave without doing anything, and it's automatically debited against your Amazon Pay account. But the question is whether beyond the Amazon Go stores, there's going to be much adoption of this. Amazon would like to see airports, but, you know, they don't want to stop there for that checkout free shopping. With us from The Wall Street Journal, e-commerce reporter Laura Stevens. Laura, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, describe a little bit more in the Amazon Go stores. Have there been kinks along the way in going without a checkout system?
Well, we initially reported more than a year ago back when they first launched it just for employees. There were some delays in getting it open, and that was in part because it is really difficult to see how humans pick things up off of shelves and really track that well throughout the store. But that's something that they've really worked out at this point. Their smaller format stores are doing really well. You track people quite well throughout the store to see what you're picking up and walking out with and charging you correctly. But now they're looking at potentially moving that into bigger spaces, which is a bigger challenge.
And how do they do this? People pick things up off the shelf. They put it back in other locations than the shelf they took it on. how are they able to track this?
Well, so there's a series of video cameras throughout the store. They also have weight sensing meters in the shelf. So basically, as a consumer, you scan your phone as you walk into the store. It has an app-generated code that then tracks you throughout the store as a 3D object. And as you're grabbing things off the shelves and putting it back other places, I've tested it out, it does track you and follow what you're doing. It's like measuring the weight of what you're picking up, but also kind of tracking you and what you're picking up. And the machine learning's gotten really good that it can really track what you're grabbing.
And how quickly do you get on your phone notification of what you purchased? So in case there is an error, you can quickly go back and correct it.
So it takes a few minutes for you to get your receipt, but it's very rare at this point. Amazon has told me that it's very rare that people are seeing mistakes. And if it did make a mistake, it would probably be that you walked out with something that it didn't charge you for, in which case you get to actually keep it.
All right. How is Amazon attempting to sell this to airports?
Well, so there have been reports that it's looking to put this technology into the same kind of format, this convenience store format at airports. So that's one thing that they're looking at. They're also looking at potentially moving it into bigger spaces, so more of a grocery store type format. But there's a lot of challenges with that because it's a very big space. There's high ceilings, and that's something where you have to have the technology really work even better, I guess, to be able to track so many items and from a higher distance.
And would Amazon control these stores, or would they be licensing this to other retailers and Amazon see that's really where they'd make the money?
At this point, our reporting points to them wanting to use this technology for themselves. They're definitely planning to open a lot of different Amazon Go stores, these smaller format stores that are a lot like a convenience store, I think 7-Eleven. They're looking at potentially trying to make that technology work in bigger stores, which obviously might have implications for Whole Foods. And then at this point, though, talking to different sources, it does sound like it would be difficult for Amazon to license this or sell this to other retailers just because they are a major competitor and a lot of people might be suspicious about that. But it remains to be seen how that might work out.
All right. We're talking with Laura Stevens, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers e-commerce. We have another guest joining us from Forrester Research. Sucharita Kodali will talk with us about the growth potential here. And is licensing the technology something that Amazon would look at? What about other stores potentially going checkout free as well? And can loss be prevented at a sufficient level that it doesn't cause financial harm to the retailers? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back in just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, the hundreds of television shows now available through streaming services. In just a few years, we have seen production explode on television programs. But with Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, CBS with their streaming services, all these different streaming services and everybody trying to have their original content, has that created such a glut? You can't even find what you want to watch. Is the abundance of riches, in fact, a detriment to watching programming on streaming services? We'll talk about that a little bit later this hour. But right now, we're looking at Amazon attempting to expand on its Amazon Go format. These are stores that are checkout free. So you just scan your phone with its code when you enter the store. You grab whatever you want. You leave as quickly as you want. You don't have to do even a self-serve checkout. It monitors what you picked up and what you're taking out of the store and bills you accordingly. If you have questions for our guests about this Amazon shopping experience, whether you think it's workable and whether you'd like to see it for other products, is 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. As I mentioned, e-commerce analyst at Forrester Research in Massachusetts, Sucharita Kudali joining us. Sucharita, thanks so much. Do you think that other retailers are closely watching Amazon's experiment with this?
Yeah, Larry, I think that Laura's point earlier is absolutely true, that retailers are probably not going to be able to adopt this anytime soon, but they're absolutely watching Amazon. And there is a lot of fascination with what the Go stores are able to do, and this idea of artificial intelligence in the physical store and leveraging computer vision to see what products people pick up and walk around with is absolutely an area of fascination, particularly for some of these multi-category, multi-mass merchandise stores.
And is the thought that convenience stores would be the place that we would start to see this, or is the expense of the hardware and software to do this such that the margins aren't sufficient in a typical convenience store?
Well, I think that the idea of a convenience store or a drugstore or a store like a 7-Eleven or a store in a gas station are the vision, because that's this type of format, the similar size of store that the Go store is now. So when other retailers think about where it's possible, that's the reason why you have shelving, you have a lot of packaged goods, and you have relatively small format without a lot of people crowding a store all at once. So those are the places where it overlaps. You're absolutely right. The technology is not cheap. It probably at this point in time is so early stage, especially with the cameras and the sensors that need to be put in the store. The amount of server capacity that's needed is just enormous, and it likely amounts to millions of dollars per store. There are very, very few stores, especially in the convenience store space, that even have the margins to be able to afford that right now. So that's part of why I think Amazon's keeping it to itself for now, because there's just not a huge market for it, certainly not in the United States, possibly in some markets in Asia. In fact, you already have JD and Alibaba, who are two of the leading retailers in China, already with their versions of Amazon Go live in their markets.
Is there a concern that theft is going to be a serious problem here? Because I know the markets that they're doing this in, Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, I don't know what neighborhoods, if there are areas with high or low amounts of shoplifting. But has there been a problem with that, to your knowledge?
Well, actually, theft is lower at a store like this for a couple of reasons. One is that you cannot enter the store unless you scan your mobile app. So there needs to be an app, and there needs to be a payment method associated with the app. There are these kiosks that, you know, like you walk into a big building and there are kiosks that often will gate whether or not you can even enter. It's the same thing in the Go store. And then once you're there, the camera vision, the computer vision tracks all of your movements and what you pick up. So theft is not really an issue at all in these stores. That's actually one of the return on investment, kind of use cases that's cited, is that the loss prevention issues and the theft in the store is actually better than in a traditional convenience store or another small format store. The issues where you sometimes see technology and loss prevention being more of a topic is in those scan and go scenarios where it's not camera vision, but it's the consumer themselves that has to scan their items and they can just walk out the door. Like Walmart had that a few years, they've had a few experiments with it over time. And theft is definitely an issue in those cases because there's not the camera that can supervise whether or not the shopper is actually getting charged for what they picked up and put in their bag.
Yeah, we have a supermarket a couple blocks from our studios to great fanfare. Put in the self-checkout only to find there were just too many people checking out without checking out, and they had to very quickly get rid of it. Jesse tweets at AirTalk, somewhat sarcastically, "Since Amazon already monitors every other aspect of my life, I'm glad they'll now also be monitoring my every movement inside of their stores." 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Matt in Brea, you're on AirTalk.
I see this as just another way of minimizing or eliminating human contact. The technology is now on a life on its own, and there's no stopping it, but people can no longer exist without their smartphone on them, and nobody turns to say hello or smile or anything in line while waiting. I'm not in favor of it, but there's no stopping it.
I am. So another barrier to human interaction. Laura Stevens of the Wall Street Journal, have any people talked about this, or is it a self-selecting group of people who choose to shop at Amazon Go and don't care about that?
It's interesting because it has eliminated cashiers, but there's still a lot of people in the store. At least I'm in San Francisco. Our office is actually across the street from one of these, so I've gone in a few times. There's still a lot of people there offering to help you, you know, figure out what you're trying to do, help you download the app. So there's a lot of human interaction at this point. It remains to be seen if humans will be needed to staff the store at that level for forever, or if it's something where you'll just be eliminating essentially that cashier. Amazon has said that it will keep humans in the store because they need them for restocking, for helping customers. And it's just eliminating that friction as you leave.
We had a chain of smaller footprint grocery stores called Fresh and Easy in Southern California that weren't able to compete in the market and exited. But when they were open, the stores were kind of strange to go into because there were seemingly only a couple of employees in the whole store. It was self-checkout with the customers. And I found it a little difficult to get used to, especially if there were hardly any shoppers in there. It's kind of like going to a ghost store. And it's just so different than what we're used to with a full-scale supermarket and people stocking shelves and, you know, running around the aisles of the supermarket. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sucharita Kodali of Forrester Research, how much growth do you anticipate this no-checkout retail undergoing in the next few years?
Well, it is very, very much in its early stages. Literally, Amazon Go is the only store in the United States, and there are only a few of them. So we can count them on probably two hands, the number of these stores that exist at this moment in time. How rapidly they grow will depend on the appetite for investment. And I think that that's really the challenge, is that I think that we will still be having this conversation inflation in 10 years. And it, by no stretch of the imagination, is going to dominate all of retail. There may be certain sectors like convenience stores, like maybe this type of technology may replace some of the Hudson News type stores that you have in airports. But is it going to be the prevailing way that commerce is done? Most likely not. Your point about, you know, kind of human interaction, one of the biggest reasons that people are still in the Amazon Go stores is that it's replenishment of goods is something that people need to do. Every time somebody takes something off a shelf, somebody needs to put the items back in place to fill that empty shelf space. Robotics has not replaced that yet. So the human need will continue to be there unless we are at a point where we can combine the robotics with the computer vision. I look at some of the most successful grocers in physical retail, and it's companies like Trader Joe's, which are, you know, almost on the other extreme, where they're extremely human-centric, and they have lots of employees in the store. And in fact, they don't even have self-checkout. So it's almost the opposite of, you know, employing, you know, too much technology. That's a store that very, very much relies on humans and seems to be thriving even in spite of doing that.
So, Sucharita, it sounds like until they're able to robotically restock where the sensors are on the shelf, you might not get the kind of cost savings that this could potentially offer, because the labor costs, if you're having to every item replace it immediately after purchase, that's a lot of labor.
Well, it is quite a bit of labor. I from the Go stores that I've visited, usually there are about three people in the store. There's usually a person in the front telling people how to use the app. There's a person manning the alcohol section, and then there's usually one, sometimes two people actually, you know, kind of pushing the items forward on the shelf so that all of the shelves look full. And not to mention, there are often people in the back making like banh mi sandwiches and all of the fresh food that is made for the Go stores as well, although some of that may migrate to bakeries and, you know, offsite facilities in the future. So there are absolutely people, and some of that may not be as necessary over time as the computer vision, you know, improves. But especially if they're talking about large format stores, they're going to need more people to replenish the shelves.
We have Gina in Culver City who says, I'm very against this because of the unemployment that would be caused looking at this down the road. Also, what does this mean to the further data? You know, we had the listener who was tweeting about this, about Amazon now having even more information. Laura Stevens of the Wall Street Journal. What sort of value does that potentially have to Amazon, that it's not just your online Amazon delivered purchases, but it's also what you're buying in brick and mortar stores, which gives a further profile of your spending habits?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It's an interesting thing to look at, because, you know, a lot of my sources will even say Amazon's a data company. It's not just an online retailer. It knows a lot about how we shop, especially online, and that's enabled it to be a very successful advertiser as well, selling a lot of different advertisements to various brands and sellers and companies out there. So it's an interesting thing to think, because we definitely browse differently in stores than we might search for something online. Online, it tends to be very targeted. In a store, we might, you know, wander by something. It might catch our eye. We might pick it up and look at it. So it does teach Amazon something different about us. It depends on how they decide to use that data, but they are very good at building a whole profile of a customer so that they really understand you, how you shop, and what you might want in the future.
Laura Stevens of the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much. We appreciate it. E-commerce reporter based in San Francisco, and Sucharita Kodali, e-commerce analyst at Forrester Research in Cambridge, Mass. Thank you for being with us as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Speaking of Amazon, its Prime Video service, one of the major streamers, a huge customer for original content, which it's streams to subscribers. Netflix, of course, Hulu, and CBS has its own streaming service. Many of them out there now. But when you're looking at hundreds of shows to try and make your way through it, how do you even decide what to watch? We'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Last hour on Air Talk, we focused on Christmas music. Is it coming too early? Well, if you like Christmas music, Terry has a special show for you coming up in about 20 minutes on Fresh Air today. It's Roots and Rockabilly Christmas Songs by in-studio performer J.D. McPherson and his band. So their new Christmas album called Socks, Fresh Air with Terry Gross and her guest, composer J.D. McPherson and his band on Fresh Air coming up next. Right now, though, it's the glut of television programming available through streaming services. Hundreds of programs. They just get constantly added to Netflix, Prime Video, Hulu, CBS's, HBO Go. So many different services that offer streaming now. South Park actually took this on a recent episode.
Netflix, you're greenlit. Who am I speaking with?
Yes, hello. We have an idea for a show that we think would be great for Netflix.
Okay, great. Would you like a pilot or just go straight to an order of 6 episodes?
We'd like to go right into 6 episodes with a pickup option at the end of 3.
Got it. Can you start shooting next month?
Got a show about transsexual dragons here.
Yes, we're ready to start right now. We are very, very excited.
Okay, sounds great. We'll send you the contracts.
Well, I don't know if it works quite like that, but it seems like Netflix, Prime, some of these streaming services are so keen on putting content there for subscribers that their role of gatekeeper maybe isn't all that strict. And that's been parodied on Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and as you heard on South Park. With us is Hollywood reporter, digital media editor, Natalie Jarvie. Natalie, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So is there a growing sense that these streamers really aren't being particularly rigorous about the programming they're choosing to stream?
Well, I don't know if it works quite the way that South Park depicted it, but certainly Netflix is leading the charge in this demand for more programming. I don't know that you can say that they're not being discerning, but certainly something has shifted. You know, when they first started, Netflix was very focused on premium programming, shows like House of Cards, directed by David Fincher. They wanted to prove to viewers that they could make the kinds of programming that you could find on an HBO. But that was really just the beginning. What Netflix wants to be is your entire television lineup. So they don't want to just be your HBO. They want to be your NBC and your CBS and maybe your Bravo. So now what you're starting to see is that they've really doubled down on original programming spending, and they're starting to greenlight a lot of shows that, you know, fill the, you know, the cable dial. So, you know, you've got your reality shows and unscripted content, documentaries, movies even now. So they're certainly ratcheting up the level of programming that they're producing.
Mary Knopf, one of our producers, was telling us in our morning meeting as we were talking about this, she wasn't feeling that well last night, sat down, she's going to watch something on Netflix. And by the time she started going through everything, it was just overload. It was so much. She just closed her laptop and that was it. And I wonder for some of our listeners, are you reaching that point where there's so much on the streaming services, it's just more trouble than it's worth to actually wade through it to find what you want to watch? And if you find that challenging, what are the ways that you decide what you're going to watch on a streaming service? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Have you lost some of your enthusiasm for watching some of the original programming that's on streaming services as they have doled out more and more contracts and are throwing on more and more content? Has it made it more challenging and less pleasurable to give a try to some of the things that they put on? 866-893-KPECC. One of the things I find fascinating, Natalie, is how many stand-up programs. I know it's cheap to film a stand-up comedian at a venue and put that on, but it just seems like every day there's a new comedian on Netflix or Prime.
Absolutely. And that's an area that they saw a real wide open space a few years ago. Before Netflix got into that game, it was really only HBO and Comedy Central that were making stand-up programs. And Netflix saw that there was a big opportunity to get into that space. And as a result, they've really started to break some young, up-and-coming comedic talent, talent that probably would not have gotten a special on an HBO. But Netflix, because they're buying so many of these, is willing to give them a shot. And it's turning out really well. I mean, Hannah Gadsby is a great example of someone very few people had heard of until she had her Netflix special. And now she's, her profile has really risen as a result.
Yeah. And again, it's cheap programming. It's pretty easy to go, you know, rent a theater, put the cameras in, invite a crowd, and record a comedian. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What's the latest number of original series that are now on streaming services? Do you have a count, Natalie?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, a lot of these companies don't like to share. Netflix especially won't tell you exactly how many they've got. But Netflix itself has over 100 a year. So when you add in the, several dozen that all the other streamers do in addition, you know, we're talking, it's an additional, several hundred programs that are added to the, already existing shows that are on your, traditional linear TV. So it's a lot.
All right. Variety last year just had a Hub Entertainment Research survey that I was looking at that published the increase in the number of people who responded. There's so many TV programs to choose that it's hard to know where to start. That went from just over 40% to about half of those within a 3-year period of time. So that feeling of being overwhelmed seems like it's a growing trend among American video consumers. Caitlin in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. So the way I feel about being so overwhelmed is I generally go with my friends' recommendations, and I try not to explore too much on my own because I do feel so like I'd rather just close the laptop, like what your producer said.
Yeah, just falling down the rabbit hole, and then you're just too tired to actually watch the show.
Yes, exactly.
I've had the experience where I've sat down to watch something and saw all this stuff I was interested in, started building my personal list, and then realized I'd run out of time to actually watch one of the shows that I was putting on my watch list. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Daniel in West Hollywood, how do you deal with this?
Hey, Larry, I'm loving this conversation. So I'm actually the founder of a startup called Bundler, and we offer a guide where we bring together content listings from each streaming service and TV network, because we've kind of were anticipating this problem of not just fragmentation, where you have to go into each app to see what's on there, but also just the incredible glut of content and the fact that now, services are trying to wean you off of licensed programming that you may be familiar with. You may go search Friends, search West Wing, on to kind of newer programs, franchises they're trying to launch. So what we do is try to pick out kind of the best or the most relevant content from each service and bring it all together. So you have a single place to browse and search. And we think that's sort of inevitable, right?
How do you customize that for the user? Or is it based on, is Bundler like a gatekeeper in and of itself?
It's a little bit of both. So we do what most services do, which is bring together all the listings and let people sort and filter and search. Everything is there. But in order to kind of tackle this question of being overwhelmed, we regularly pick out each month kind of the notable content in each category, the most popular or well-reviewed documentaries, the best original content, notable sports stuff, etc., and then kind of tailor between those, among those categories, depending on what the user is interested in, and of course what they subscribe to.
Yeah.
You have a way you can browse just the titles within your subscription.
This is sort of the modern day TV guide, is what you're really describing, except for streaming. Daniel, thanks so much. Appreciate your talking about the business that you co-founded to try and deal with this. Natalie Jarvie, have there been other sites or apps that have attempted to provide curation of streaming?
Well, all of the streaming devices that you can hook up to your televisions have attempted to do this. So Apple, for example, a while back introduced Universal Search. So you can type or speak the name of a movie or a TV show into the search bar, and it'll pop up for you all of the places on your Apple TV where you can find that and whether or not you need to pay for it. The challenge with that for Apple is that they need these services to opt in, and Netflix has not opted in. So when you do that search, it might the movie, the TV show might be on Netflix, but Apple won't be able to tell you that. So that's when you still have to go into that Netflix app and find out for yourself. But universal search is an important tool for people to be able to find content. And I think it definitely is moving in the direction of there needing to be one place for people to find all of this content or know where to go to watch that content.
And even the TiVo that I use, the box, provides that service. But you still have to kind of know what you're looking for, as opposed to having, you know, the suggestions right there up front, or if there are suggestions that they're relevant to the guy. Because so many places you go now and they have for you, you know, and it's recommended. It's not anything necessarily that I want to watch. It's not particularly well curated for my taste. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation about the glut of streaming programming in just 1 minute. Described as the era of peak TV. Certainly in numbers, there's no question about that. Hundreds of television series from streaming services, even traditional network television, cable channels, HBO and other premium cable offerings have their own as well. But the question is, how do you make your way through that glut? How do you find stuff? And are the streaming services providing enough quality control in their offerings? You know, HBO, for example, really established a certain baseline of quality. Now, not every HBO series has been great, certainly. Some have been greater successes than others, but there's sort of a minimum of production values, of care and attention that went into the scripts and the casting. And, you know, when you see an HBO production, you have there's certain minimum standards that are at play, even if artistically it didn't really end up ringing. You know, the question is, are streaming services, you know, seeing themselves more as a compilation of networks, should they be focused more on quality control in what they're providing? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Claudia in South Pasadena, how do you deal with this?
Well, I'm coming from a different angle. I was overwhelmed by the glut because I was on the TV nominating committee for SAG this year.
Oh, man. How many series did you have to go through?
Oh, my. And I'm ahead of the game because I already subscribed to Amazon and Netflix, so I'd already seen all those shows. And Friday, Sunday was the deadline. I'm like a nervous wreck. Have I seen this? Have I covered this? Have I taken care of this? Tim Hutton, whom I adore, was nominated for three shows. Which one do I nominate? I was nominated for three shows. Which one do I nominate for? Well, I must tell you, I am totally jealous of all these platforms.
Claudia,
when I was an active actress.
Well, I was going to say, for actors, it's great. I mean, this is
fabulous.
Yeah, if you can't get cast in something, you know, get a new agent. But Claudia, I wonder, were you on the nominating committee in the old days when you just didn't have this glut of stuff to go through?
I've been on the nominating committee twice. 12 years ago, I was on the film nominating committee.
Oh, okay.
But back then, even for the TV, this wasn't there. Different things weren't even there. I don't think Hulu even existed back then.
Claudia, I appreciate it. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. If you're someone working on the Emmy committee or the SAG nominating committee, and you're trying to come up with shows, Natalie Jarvie, The Hollywood Reporter, that's got to be nerve wracking.
Absolutely. There's a challenge right now of just missing something that's really great out there because there are so many shows. And what we're finding increasingly is that people are, you know, having to choose, you know, what shows they want to sit down and watch at the end of a long day. There's not that same kind of water cooler show like there used to be. I mean, certainly Game of Thrones is kind of the last of these that everyone sits down and seems to want to talk about the next day. But it becomes increasingly hard to kind of parse what's great and what isn't when there's so many shows on the air.
Randy in Culver City says, I find the site Just Watch really useful. You type in the name of a show or movie, tells you which streaming services you can use to watch. Yeah, it's very helpful, and there are a number of places that offer that. But again, you have to know it's something you already want to see, and then it helps you find it. Sarah in Santa Monica says, I don't get overwhelmed. I look forward to what's new every month. It's easy for me. Just try something, see if it works. Picking something to watch, testing it out, helps me unwind. Adriana in Riverside, how do you decide what you're going to watch with the sea of programming?
Hi, I also don't get lost in all of the new shows on streaming. I make my decisions of what I'm going to watch on streaming services the same way I make my cable watching decisions, basically by what's winning awards and what's popular by word of mouth and among my friends on social media. It's how I found Stranger Things, The Handmaid's Tale, Black Mirror, and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. When they start winning awards, when all your friends are talking about it, you sit down and watch it.
All right, Adriana, makes sense. And yeah, I think for those very high profile shows, it's hard to miss those. But I always wonder, gosh, is there some gem that I missed that I would personally, you know, its quirkiness would appeal to my love of offbeat kind of stuff or not? And sometimes it's hard because how do you, with hundreds of shows, where do you find information about that? And Natalie Jarvie, you know, we're talking about video and the difficulty streaming there. That doesn't even begin to talk about podcasting, which has even fewer ways to try and wade through that sea of content.
Absolutely. Right now, podcasting is really dominated by the platforms that release them or that host these podcasts. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify. And I know I personally really rely on those top charts. So they'll show what are the most downloaded podcasts on Apple. And that's a really valuable tool to know what's resonating with other listeners. How can you find something that's great? But right now, you really do have to kind of rely on these platforms to tell you what's new and exciting because it is challenging to be able to search for content. There's even fewer opportunities or tools for finding all of those shows than there are in the TV space.
Mark in Costa Mesa says, when I got Netflix, I became a binge watcher, looking at old programming, old programs, but I found it difficult because of the search mechanisms to really find what I'm looking for, so I use outside compilations of the best Netflix programs. That's Mark in Costa Mesa. You can share your comments about this golden era of streaming television, peak TV as it's often called, where TV more often than not comes on streaming services, not over the air or through cable into the home. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. And Natalie Jarvie of The Hollywood Reporter, pleasure to talk with you today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Digital media editor for The Reporter. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming up next, and it's one of her in-studio performance programs. Composer J.D. McPherson and his band, their new Christmas album, Socks. It's roots and rockabilly Christmas music coming up on Fresh Air. Have a terrific afternoon, and I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.